way to do this. Let me show you a better way. You don't have to think.
And we are live, breaking one of my own rules and doing late. 4 minutes late to be exact, but it was not planned. I don't know what's going on. I've had some real internet connectivity issues today. Hopefully that will not interfere with us. I literally got kicked out of the studio 4 times before the damn thing let me go live. I'd get everything set up, I'd hit start, and I'd be back at the home screen in StreamYard in kind of the back office area. So I don't know what the hell that was, but I even put in an order today from Acura Botanicals, and that process took way longer than it's supposed to. I've been having some weird stuff go on today. So again, hopefully it will not mess things up for today's live stream. If you're tuning in for the first time, especially if you're on YouTube or any place else that we stream video to, like Facebook or X or Rumble or what have you, and you saw like stuff about cooking here and you think it's like a cooking show and we're going to be in the kitchen or whatever, we're not. This is a podcast. And so what we're going to do is we're going to talk about cooking today from a different angle. But we're going to talk about the fact that we have a real problem right now in our modern world, and we call that problem inflation. Of course, that's not a new problem, but it is a new-ish form of inflation, like a higher rate of inflation than most of us are accustomed to. The last time we really had the pain of inflation like we've had in the last 5 years would have been, you know, the middle to the late 1970s, even going into the early 80s before Reagan kind of took over and made some structural changes and some things to mitigate for a time the consequences of fiat currency that fully began in 1971. Today, we're experiencing 70s-like inflation. That's the best way to describe it. If people call it hyperinflation, don't know what hyperinflation is. Hyperinflation has a very specific definition. If we had hyperinflation for as long as we've had this high inflation, everything would be over by now and we'd be completely burned to dust and rebooted economically in some form or fashion we would have had to. Because what you're talking about is an inflation rate that basically doubles prices every couple weeks. That's what hyperinflation is. But while we don't have that, it is a lot more expensive to live today. And at the same time, when we look at food in particular, people eat out more than they ever have, and people are doing something today that is really expensive that we didn't do even 15 years ago, let alone 30 years ago, because it didn't exist. Basically, you're buying an expensive taxi ride for a taco. What does that mean? Uber, Eats, DoorDash, all of that shit. Like, it used to be if you ordered food delivered, it was probably pizza. Maybe it was chicken wings or something like that that came from a pizza joint. Or maybe if you lived in the right place, maybe it was Chinese, right? If you're in New York City, I know you can get anything delivered all the time. At least back then you could. But there wasn't a lot of places that really delivered food. Today, you can get anything delivered. And they'll stop by, you know, CVS and pick some shit up for you, some bags of potato chips to go with it if you want it. And so we have people spending more money on food than ever, when food costs more money than ever, but not by choice, or not by just the price of the food going up, but by choices. They're making choices to buy the most expensive versions of the shittiest food. I mean, if you think about the food that people are eating, even like mid-tier restaurants that used to be pretty damn good just 15, 20 years ago, at this point, all they're doing is reheating shit off a Cisco truck. And it's all full of garbage and junk, and the price is higher than it's ever been. And so it's kind of crazy to me that you have people complaining about the cost of things who are buying taxi rides for tacos and going to dog shit level restaurants and spending tons of money on food that they say they don't have money for while going deeper into debt and not learning the basic skills of cooking for themselves. Now, to be fair, I think there's been a bit of a renaissance of cooking. Cooking channels on YouTube, for instance, are some of the most popular channels there are now. And some of the biggest consumers of them are young adults who are finally out on their own, and they're coming into like head-to-head smashing. It turns out a taxi ride for your taco is a lot more of a problem when mom and dad aren't paying some of your bills, right? Like all of a sudden that taxi ride for the taco means a whole bunch of other things you can't do that week. So they're learning how to do it. But what we're not really learning is what I call traditional foods. I'm gonna tell you a couple things about today. Those of you that know me know that I eat mostly a keto type diet, sometimes almost full on carnivore, but definitely keto-ish. I'm not gonna let myself be bound by that today. In fact, I'm gonna give you some reasons that I think we are fat and sick today, in spite of the fact that, like, in the 1970s when I was a little kid, almost everybody was skinny, and we ate the shit out of carbs, and we drank Coke. And the number one dessert that parents made for kids in the 80s and 70s was fucking Jell-O. Something's wrong. So we'll finish with what's wrong, but we're going to start with what's right. I'm going to talk about some cooking hacks, just some things you can do from a technique standpoint to get better results out of food that's inexpensive to begin with. I'm going to talk about some things you can make, things that I love. I'm going to give you the basics of making something like a good quality soup, and not here's how to make chicken soup. Here's how to make soup. You can make any friggin' soup you want. And if you want it to be stew, make bigger pieces and thicken the broth. And I'm going to go through kind of some fun stuff. I'm going to give you a ton of things that my grandma used to make. And I'm talking about my Ukrainian grandma. Now, my Ukrainian grandma, you did not want to let this woman near a steak. She would destroy it. I'm talking a half inch of water in a cast iron skillet, and a porterhouse goes into it, and it gets boiled on both sides, flipping it occasionally until there's no water left, then a knob of butter, and then fry it after you boil the shit out of it. She was old school. She lived through the Depression, but she also, you know, was a first generation immigrant from Ukraine. And you're talking about the turn of the century, the last century, you asshole kids to say, so you were born in the latter half of the last century. Shut up. The last century, right? And so she grew up at a time when there was no refrigeration. And even after refrigeration was a thing, that didn't mean you had it. So they had a certain fear of not cooking meats long enough because of that. But otherwise, like if it was you're baking something or something that could handle being cooked low and slow or long, like a pot roaster, she was a freaking wizard. She really was. And she had to feed a really big family on a very low income, including after World War II. She was raising my dad and my two uncles. And my grandfather was a hardworking man, but between black lung and then surviving a coal mine collapse, eventually his body was just too broken to work and he was on disability. And so she worked part-time here and there, and they were on disability, and they had to raise a family with three kids and three boys. Did a lot of shit. And like they did offset that, because I wasn't around yet, with hunting and gardening and foraging and fishing. But it still takes a lot to feed that many people. You can only get so much from the land. And so I'm going to share with you some of her stuff. Some of it has its roots in Slovakian, you know, Ukrainian, Polish type cooking. And some of it is just stuff that she made. And then I'm going to talk about staying healthy even if you're not low carb. Just some basic stuff you can do that will drastically improve your health no matter what you eat. And then I'm going to talk about the six big changes. Remember what I said, we're going to end with the problem this time instead of start with the problem. I'm going to give you six big changes that have been made since in my lifetime. Okay, I'm in my 50s, right? In my lifetime, but I was very young when these changes actually went into place, at least fully, because you're talking about mid-80s by the time it completely took over. But it's these six changes that I personally believe have caused society to become fat and sick and unhealthy to a large degree. And all one has to do to prove this to themselves, go find any video footage in a highly populated area that you can from the 1970s. A beach, a park, a school, I don't care where. Just anything that you have, like where it's not, because if it's two people, you generally, especially back then, you know, video cameras were really expensive. Not everybody walked around with one in their pocket. And so back then, if you were going to put a video on somebody, like specific, you put it on a person that was attractive to put it on. Okay, I'm just going to say that. And people got ready for it. It was a much bigger deal than it is today. But when you like go to the beach and there's 300 people in the shot, they're not all prepared to be on video. Go look at the video from 1970, 1975, and then go look at a video from as recent as, let's say, 95, let alone 2025, in the same type of arrangement. And you're going to find that adults in particular, about half of them are not just overweight, they're obese today. And videos of kids in like schools, including like high schools, college, when they should be in their prime shape, you know, you're still looking at like 30%, 25 to 30% are not just overweight, obese. But when you go look at those old videos, the guys in there that you would pick out as he's kind of heavy, nobody even would look twice at that today. Like, he's got a bit of a dad bod. That's all they would say. They would not be like, that guy's fat. In fact, if you go back to like the 1920s when we still had freak shows, and you look at the freaks that were the fat guy at the freak show, like people paid money to look at them, that guy wouldn't turn a single head in a line at Walmart today. Something went drastically wrong. So we'll talk about that too, so that you can have more freedom in your eating, but at the same time, you can realize the dangers and the risks, and maybe you'll be more likely to take my staying healthy advice because of that. And then I'm going to ask you something. At the end, I'll ask you a question, and I want you guys to respond by emailing me, and maybe we'll do another show out of this one. All right. So before we dig into all of that, because it's going to be a great show today, let's go ahead and talk about our sponsors of the day. Sponsor day number one today is Canine Academy. That's Joel Ryle's operation. Did you know that every moment with your dog while building obedience, confidence, and control through proven training will deliver real results? That's what it really takes. Is you have to take all the time that you're with your dog and realize something. You're always training them, right? Everything you do or don't do, everything you allow to happen, you are training your dog that this is either acceptable or unacceptable behavior. And so when you don't get that right, you end up training in things you think you're trying to train out. But with Joel Ryle's method, which is you create conditions that allow the animal to fail, you control those conditions so the failure is not catastrophic, and you correct the failure, and you do that over time to condition a response. You end up with a dog that behaves where people go, wow, I can't believe how well trained your dog is. But here's the trick. You didn't really train the dog. You learned to train yourself, and your training created a well-trained dog. That's how that works. You can learn out how to do that at canineacademy.us with some great online courses, including a problem-solving library that you can sign up for right now for free at no cost to get a feel for what Joel's training is like. Next up today is Biltong USA. Anton Van Vuren runs Biltong USA. It is a really great online shop that not only offers some great Biltong, it offers a lot of other really cool imported items around the world. Anton actually got started because he wanted to bring the things that he knew of from around the world to America and teach people about his way of eating, the South African way of eating, and some other places he had been. He had come here from South Africa as a legal immigrant, just got settled in, built a little cafe with a little restaurant and a little store, and that was late 2019. Oops. All of a sudden, he shut down, locked down, et cetera, and he really ramped up the Biltong at that point because it was a product that was unique and could be shipped at a time when everybody was buying everything through the mail. Now he has he's open on site again and all, has all the other things, but the Biltong is what he's really known for. He actually pays his sponsorship bill to me, partly in money and partly in Biltong sticks, Drewor sausages, things like that. Check him out today at Biltong USA. Your stomach will thank you. And you know what's not in any of Anton's Biltong or sausages? High fructose corn syrup or, you know, things. Like seed oils and stuff like that, right? It's meat, salt, spices, a little bit of vinegar, right? Maybe a little bit of powdered honey to help with the fermentation process. It's awesome. You should try it. All right. So now let's get into this. Now, I think what's going to happen today is even those that kind of find us through side avenues that are not long-term listeners, you might actually be happy that I'm not doing any of this in the kitchen or something like that, because I'm probably going to make you pretty hungry today at some point along the way as I talk about these different things, especially some of the stuff from my childhood, including some stuff that will turn things that you would think of as garbage into greatness. I mean, really, a fantastic some of the things that my grandma used to do. But let's start off with a hack. So one of the things people have done is retreat into the world of ground beef. Is a way to deal with the fact that a freaking steak can be $16, $18 a pound now for a kind of like USDA choice, not even prime like ribeye. It's ridiculous how expensive it's got. So a lot of people are doing more with ground meat because that's from all the trimmings. It tends to cost less. Though in the grocery stores right now, it's costing around $7, $8, $9 a pound for basic everyday 80/20 or 85/15 ground beef. I'll tell you later how to save a ton of money on that as well. But here's the problem that I see with most people when they cook ground beef. And I'm specifically talking about where part of the recipe is brown the ground beef in a pan, right? They don't brown the ground beef. They gray it. Gray is not good. Like I always said, if I ran prisons, everything in the prison would be gray, including the food, because you wouldn't want to go back when I was done, right? Gray is bad. We don't want gray food. I don't really know many foods that are great when they're gray anyway. Maybe scrapple, but you still, it's much better if you brown it, right? So why do most people, no matter how high they set the temperature, no matter how good the pan is, why do they end up with gray ground beef with no brown on it? It's straight up technique. So what most people do, they take the pan, you've got, let's say 80/20 or 85/15 ground beef. Okay, you got plenty of fat, you don't need any fat. First thing they do is put a big old lug of fat in there. Okay, so now we've already put more moisture in the pan than we need to. It's still not terrible, but it doesn't help. And then what they do, they take the beef and they either crumble it in the pan or they throw the whole lump in there and they start immediately chopping it up. Well, what happens then? There's actually quite a bit of water and there's certainly quite a bit of fat in that meat. And as the heat hits it and it's opened up like that, it dumps all of it. Now you end up with, you know, a quarter inch of liquid in the pan. And everything under the liquid is basically boiling or slow poaching in the oils, but it ain't browning. And everything above the liquid line is steaming. That results in grade beef, not brown beef. What is the solution? Well, get your pan nice and hot. Use a good carbon steel, cast iron, stainless steel if that's what your jam is. But I'm big on carbon steel for stuff like this. And take your big old chunk of ground beef and plunk it in there like a steak. Just plunk it in there like a steak and just let it sit. Give it a couple minutes on high heat. It'll char like a big giant hamburger, which is kind of what it is, isn't it? Turn the whole block over and let that happen again. Char the outside of both sides. The center is barely even warming up yet if it's a big thick piece, okay? Now go ahead and break it up. Now you're going to have some that doesn't quite brown, okay? Because the liquid is going to discharge, that's going to happen. But you've got all this wonderful surface area mixed through it. You want to maximize that? Take that big chunk of ground meat you bought. Take a knife and cut it right down the center. And I mean across the thin, right? So that you're making a book out of it. So you go from one thin side to the other and you leave your wide sides exposed. So now you have like two hands shape of beef. Do the same thing with both of them and flip them. Now you've doubled the surface area and the amount of it will actually get browned. See how cool, see how simple that is. We didn't do anything as to changing ingredients. We didn't use some special fat that we painted the pan with and then it contemplated our navel and held our pinky up and then prayed to the brown gods in the sky or whatever. All we did was change the structure of the meat when we put it in the pan. If you've ever made burgers, you know when you put a burger in a hot pan like that, you get that nice crust. That's part of what makes it so delicious. Just do the same thing with your ground beef. Now ask yourself, why didn't anybody ever tell you that before? And the answer is because most people don't know. Now, on ground beef, I want to talk about why grinding your own brisket or your own chuck in general, or even like sirloin and shit like that, right now beats the hell out of buying ground beef. First of all, when you go to the store, the ground beef that you're getting, it's in the deli case or in the display case, and it's not in the big chubs, right? It's in a nice little styrofoam with a cellophane over it, and it looks all brand new and fresh. Most of that meat came in already ground. They do very little meat cutting at the stores anymore. They get these great big, the same great big cheap-ass chub of meat you won't buy. They reprocess it through a grinder. It takes the outside that's kind of sad looking and folds it in with everything else. It's nice and bright red. It looks less oxidized. They put it in there, and you think they just ground up all the fresh trimmings for you. They did not. So the quality alone just isn't there of what you could do when you grind your own. But let's look at – I'm gonna say a few things about, like, if you have a Costco business center that you can go buy big primals and stuff. But I'm going to start out with this. It is very common for me to go up to Albertson's up the road for me to go shopping, walk through the meat case, and there'll be brisket in there, trimmed brisket. Okay, not fully, completely all defatted. It's like a perfect ratio for grinding for about $4 a pound. Now, I'm not going to say I can go do that every day of the week. I'm saying it's very common for them to have a little more brisket than they want to put it on sale for that price. But Jack, it's brisket. It's incredibly good as ground beef, and it costs $3-4 a pound less than the cheapy, shitty ground beef. This is one of the reasons I say of the equipment you can buy that pays for itself relatively quickly, there's really three that I feel that way about when it comes to meat. A grinder, which is what does it here, a flat top griddle because of the quality you can achieve and how much less eating out you will do, and a sandwich meat slicer. Those three in time pay for themselves really, really, really quickly. But if you do have like a Costco business center, I was looking today, under $6 a pound. Sirloin, top sirloin, but whole sirloins, both. Bottom round and top round, both. Beef cheeks, don't grind those. We'll talk about those in a bit, okay? That's just like, these are just giving you an idea of some of the inexpensive cuts you can get. Okay, but Jack, the bottom round and the top round is too lean. So you buy the big packer brisket, and when you trim it to cook it so it doesn't like completely swamp your smoker in grease, you cube up the fat and you put it in little 1 pound packets and you throw it in the freezer and you kind of lay them out so you can get it out, and then that way it's frozen fat and goes right in your grinder with your top and bottom round. But you can buy a whole chuck clod for like $5.16 a pound at the Costco Business Center in Dallas. A whole chuck clod, $5.16 a pound. Okay, the ground beef, and what I'm going to do with that, I'm going to take certain cuts out, like the Denver steaks and the chuck eyes and some other stuff, and then about half of it's going to get ground. And it's basically cut one tendon off and everything else is grindable. And that's going to make me a quality of burger that you can't touch. If you don't have access to any of that, but you do have access to a Costco, and I don't know what Sam's Club has, because they usually have something sort of analogous to what Costco has. But Costco right now sells organic ground beef for about $6 a pound. Organic ground beef, prepackaged, they're about 1.3 pounds per package, and they sell them in three packs. $6 a pound, $6.12 or something like that is what we paid last time we bought some. And it's very high quality meat. It's delicious. So even if you can't do those other things, you can do that. And then remember how to brown your ground beef instead of gray, because gray is not good. Then the beef cheeks. Oh, my God. This is something I was doing a little research for the show. I wasn't even going to put this in the episode. And then this memory came back to me of a restaurant that no longer exists because COVID killed it. It was called the Bird Cafe, and they made, among other things, the best old-fashioned you could order in a bar anywhere I've ever been. I'm not going to say anywhere in the world, but I've been to a lot of places, and I had a lot of old-fashions, and theirs was just something beyond. They made their own cherry liquor and their own orange liquor, and they used actually splashes of those instead of just the orange peel and stuff. It was amazing. But one of their best dishes was actually on their appetizer menu, and it was certainly big enough to be a portion for a meal, but if you had like four people, it was a great app to share. And it was braised beef cheeks with a smoky white bean and bacon side next to it. And what they did is they braised those beef cheeks until they were super tender. Then they pulled them and let them firm up. So when you have really super, fall apart meat, if you cool it down, it actually firms back up. And then they would take that and they would put those whole pieces of beef cheek on the flat top to warm it up and crust the outside. Nice smear of those beans, and then set that beef cheek on top of there. Oh, good God. was that delicious. And yes, you can make it yourself. And yes, I have. And yes, I cooked beans. And no, I'm not sorry. Okay. That was one of the best things I ever learned just by going to a restaurant. That is incredibly cheap. If they don't have beef cheeks at your market and you don't have a Costco business center, look for like a Mexican grocery store. Like most cities, towns today, larger ones anyway, have like one that caters to Hispanics, and they almost always have like beef tongues for making tacos de lengua and beef cheeks, and so, and you can always find beef heart and other cool stuff at those places. I don't know about Asian places if they would have a beef cheek, but you might check there too. You might check there too if you're having trouble finding these. And it was like I looked up today at my Costco business, there was like four something a pound. I can't believe that. Beef cheek should be one of the, and it's the face cheek, not the ass cheek. That would be top round. Beef cheek should be literally one of the most premium meats on the planet. And don't go telling everybody. Let's not do to beef cheek what we did to chuck eye. Like that sucks. That sucks when that happens. When we do that. And somebody here is saying something about, I think this person is saying basically they're buying local beef. If you can do that, yeah, do that. Pork shoulder. I see pork shoulder is one of the most underrated meats on the planet. And, you know, I might mention like the cheapest version, like you can buy a double pack of boneless pork shoulder at Costco for like $2.40 or something like that. Right. And then you might be thinking, but I want to eat a higher quality. Everything I'm saying, no matter what class you move into, you know, free range, you know, raised by orphans with flowers blown on their foreheads, Kobe, Japanese, wherever you go, the lesser cost things cost less than the higher cost things within the class. All right. But in the case of pork shoulder, yeah, you can go to Costco and you can buy two whole boneless pork shoulders for well under $3 a pound. It was $1.89 a pound at the business center when I looked it up this morning. And again, in Dallas, I mean, prices may vary. So under $2 a pound. There are so many things you can do with pork shoulder. If you just grind it up to make ground pork, it makes the perfect pork rind. It makes the perfect any kind of sausage you want to make a pork sausage, you're going to flavor it with. All you do is take one of those, cut it up and grind it, and then mix your shit into it. I mean, that's how simple that is. If you're cutting deer meat because you want more fat, it makes about 25% of that to 75% venison. Perfect ratios for sausage, assuming you're not a person who doesn't eat pork. But if you learn how to take one of those apart, there are some real gems within them. The first is there's about half of the copa is what it's called. So if you've ever had a ham called capricola, that is this neck right here. And the shoulder, the neck goes back into the shoulder. And the boneless ones you get from Costco, I've been disappointed a couple times where one was missing, usually has a copa inside it. When you pull that copa out, you can cut about four chops that are about 1 inch thick. Those will be the best pork chops you will ever eat in your effing life, I promise you. And then your larger piece, you got kind of a flappy, sloppy piece, and that piece is best to grind and use it as pork ground for sausage, breakfast sausage, whatever. It can also be thin sliced and used for stir fry and all. But your thicker piece, when you have that thicker piece and you just basically cut it into what looks like steaks, unlike a beef shoulder that tends to be pretty dadgone tough from that piece of it, pork is just tender, especially, you know, I hate to say it, but our modern factory pork is really tender that way. And so those are great just grilled. And there's a lot of other things you can do with this. But I just want to say that is one of the most underrated pieces of meat, and you should look into what you can do with it. And what actually makes it, I think, more underrated, like you can also buy the whole pork loins that are basically the back loin. You know, so it's like the rib loin, the strip loin, and the sirloin all in one. And it's really great meat. And I've used it a lot at workshops here. The one issue with it is there's very little fat in that cut. And there's actually a really nice fat cap on those things. And the freaking jerks that process them cut that fat cap down to where it's only about a quarter inch thick. If they would leave that damn fat cap about an inch thick, which is how thick it is when they skin that pig, it would be a lot better deal, in my opinion. It wouldn't be marbled fat, but it would be there. And that fat, when you kind of put some hash marks in it, and when you're done cooking that chop, you stand it up on the end and sear that fat and crisp it up a little bit, is amazing. But the shoulders got marbled fat all through it. And that's why that meat is so tender and juicy and versatile. There's so many things you can do it with it. I'm for some reason, pork adobo came in my head, and that is not what I'm talking about. It's another name. It's a Spanish thing, a Mexican thing, and you do it with layers of pork and pineapple and achote, which is like this red seasoning. And somebody here, tell me what that shit is called. I can't remember. I started making that in a simplified way. Maybe I'll do a video on that for you guys someday, because the way you do it with like a rotisserie and all is really, really hard. Al pastor, that's what it is. And I got there before anybody told me. No, not carnitas. That's great for carnitas too, but I like the lower leg for carnitas. Al pastor, pork. We had that at a little taco joint down in Dallas, and I'm like, down in Fort Worth. I'm like, we got to do this. And it was, even when I did my short redneck version, it was still just fantastic. So there's a lot you can do with that. Pork belly. Pork belly is, and I want to say real quick before I go on, there's a couple of people making comments and questions doing it right. I didn't announce it today. This is how you ask a question. If you're watching the live stream, if you're watching the replay, no one will know. But if you're watching the live stream and you put the word question or comment in all caps and then give me your question or comment in one sentence, I will respond to it at the end. We also have a comment here. So those are the only two I have so far. So if you didn't follow that format and you want me to talk about what you said, this is your chance to do it again. So anyway, pork belly, everything's bacon. And by God, yes, you should make your own bacon. And that's another reason that a meat slicer pays for itself. When you can set that meat slicer to any size thickness you want and cut bacon to any thickness you want, including so thick, it eats like a piece of steak or super thin or anything in between. It's pretty awesome. But pork belly to make bacon is really easy to do. I'm not going to go over how to do it today, but I like to use the equilibrium method, which means I mix up the cure. I spread it all over the pork belly. I put it in a bag. You can do that with a Ziploc bag and push the air out of it. I use a vacuum sealed bag because I have a chamber vac, and I put the belly in it, and I 7 days, and every day it flips. And then you take it out of the bag, you rinse it off, you put it back in uncovered, and let it dry so it gets sticky in the fridge for a day, and then you smoke it. And it's amazing bacon, and anybody can do it. But you don't have to do that. You can buy a whole pork belly, also very inexpensively at Costco. Bust it in half, because one is huge, unless you have a really big group of people to feed. Smoke it like a brisket. Now, I love skin-on pork belly, but unless you're prepared to do the work to get that skin to come up and chicharron for you, get skin off pork belly or skin the belly and then maybe make chicharron separately with the pork. If you do pork belly with skin on and you don't peel that skin off and you cook it with the skin on and it doesn't crisp up for you and puff up for you, it's not good eats. I'll just leave it that way. But a skin off pork belly, simply seasoned however you like and then smoked, and then just serve it like you would serve. It is so freaking delicious. And that fat is so satiating, you don't eat as much as you think you would eat. Right? And it's just fantastic. The other thing you can do with it is then dice it up after that's all done, make a glaze for it, put it back on the smoker, and make burnt ends, like brisket burnt ends, but do it out of pork belly. You'll smack your mama. I'm telling you, that's how good it is. It is unbelievable. It is unbelievable. Next, chicken thigh may be one of the most value proteins on the market. I think the last time we picked up a 40-pound case of chicken thighs at Costco, it was 80 cents, 87 cents a pound, something like that. And a chicken thigh is so versatile in what you can do. I like skin-on, bone-in thigh. And the reason I like that is I can cook it just like it is if I want to. It's delicious. It's great. Like if I'm going to throw it on the smoker at a higher temperature and do like a sweet and heat glaze for it with a dry rub, sweet and heat glaze, brush with a little beer or a little pineapple juice as you add that glaze to it. It's amazing, and because it's a thigh and it's got fat and you got the skin and bone in there, it can handle a longer cook until that skin crisps up. I can also just peel the skins off, put them aside, and later cook those like on the grill, in the oven, in a frying pan, and make basically chicken chicharrón, which is freaking delicious. And all it needs is to be cooked and have the fat rendered out of it and add some salt to it and then go to town eating it. And it's good as a chip, like just eating it. It's good on salads. It's good as things to enhance other dishes, almost using it like a crouton or something like that. So the bones, if you de-skin and debone yourself, all those bones get saved. You have enough. You throw them in the oven. You roast them. Then they go to a stock pot and you make bone stock out of them and little bits of chicken. It's like a chicken bone and stock mixed with a broth, really. And so you get that extra utility out of it. And it just makes it so versatile. But here's an example of some things you can do with it. Like last night, my wife wanted chicken fajitas. Now, for us, that means no tortillas. So basically, it's a pile of meat with like a bunch of Mexican like fajita shit on it. Like, so fresh cilantro, maybe some green onion. Last night I did, I made my own guacamole and I had one cob of corn. So I roasted it on the top of the gas stove till it charred the corn a little bit, cut that off, let it cool down, did the same thing with a poblano pepper and diced it up. And I mixed roasted corn and roasted poblano and a chunky, guacamole mash. And then I did that in the morning, so I threw the bowl inside a vac seal bag, put that in the chamber bag, vacuum sealed the whole bowl, so then the guacamole won't turn black and oxidize because it can't oxidize without oxygen. See how simple that was? Pretty cool, huh? And that was fantastic, but for the chicken part, everybody uses breast. Breast sucks for this! First of all, if you're going to make something like that, you're going to make more than you're going to eat and have leftovers. Even if you and I can nail chicken breast to where it's juicy and good. But you let it get cold, right? You keep it as a leftover. You heat it back up. It dries out. It's just not that good, and it was never that flavorful. If you overcook it for 5 seconds, it tastes like shit. You can cook the hell out of thigh. So I took the thigh, skinned and boned, put that stuff aside to do other things with, and just cut strips. Like you cut strips for fajitas. I made a marinade. It was like chili powder, garlic, and onion powder. A little bit of cardamom. I think I threw one star anise in the little spice grinder, cumin, and then that chili powder that I recommend you can find on my website. And so I mixed up that, threw it in a dish, mixed it all up, put it in a bag, and I added to the bag 1 tablespoon of soy sauce and about 1 teaspoon of Worcestershire sauce, Worcestershire sister sauce, and about 1/2 teaspoon of sherry vinegar. And then massage that all in, vacuum sealed it, left that sit all day. Just fried it, browned it. Had to do it in batches because my griddle was not playing nice with me yesterday. I got that taken care of now. And so I had to do it in batches to fit it in frying pans. There's another hack for you. When you're frying a lot of something, do it in batches. There should be, if you can't see the bottom of your skillet, you're boiling and steaming, you're not frying. Fried that up, threw it on a plate with all the stuff that we've put. It's like, oh, that's so fucking good. It's so good. And so it says, my chili powder recommendation is legit. Yeah, yeah. I think it's Frontier Organics that makes it. You can just go to my website, thesurvivalpodcast.com, and search for chili powder. They do some thing. If you read the write-up, it'll tell you. I used to make my own chili powder, and there's some things that I put in chili powder that no one else does. Apparently, these people do. There's one thing I put in it they don't. But I can always add that, and it just makes my whole life easier, and it costs me less to buy it from them, so it's a win-win. But chicken thigh, you could do so much with. Soup, chicken salad, chicken pie. Like, there's nothing that you can do with chicken breast you can't do with chicken thigh. Even if you want to do, like, kind of a breaded, thin, like, chicken fried chicken or whatever, take your thigh, bone it. You could buy it pre-boned if you want. Lay it out. Put some plastic wrap over it, get a meat tenderizer and use the flat side of it, a little basically meat hammer, and pound it thin, bread it, and fry the freaking thing. It'll taste better than doing it with chicken breast. Like, I don't know what it is with people that don't like dark meat. I think there's something wrong crisscrossing your brain, and I'm convinced if you don't like chicken, you don't like chicken. I will absolutely accept that some people don't like chicken, okay?
If you like chicken breast and you tell me you don't like chicken thigh, it's in your big old blockhead. If I blindfolded your fucking ass, you would eat it. Just like the people that, I don't like rare steak. That's because it's in your head. I promise you, if I blindfold you and have you taste three steaks, you're gonna side toward rare. I promise you, you will. Anyway, chicken breasts are obsolete. Underground fly says, I you know, there's some use for chicken breasts. They make good dog food. Honestly, no, I mean really, like chicken breast is good. I actually prefer to really nail a good herbed chicken breast and then not eat it right away. Let it put it in a vacuum sealed bag, you know, maybe two or three of them at a time. So it has time for those flavors all to marry in really well. Throw that in the refrigerator. And if you don't have a meat slicer, and the chicken breasts are kind of odd shaped anyway, take that out, really nice sharp knife, thin slice, and use it like a sandwich meat or something like that. Or eat cold, like on a serving board. Like to me, that is the best way to use white meat of chicken. And I don't consider a wing white meat, even though the meat is white in color, because it cooks differently. It can handle the higher temperatures without drying out. yeah, it's not really dog food, but hey, you know. Next, another thing to look at is chicken drumsticks. Now, I don't understand either why they're so cheap, right? They're even cheaper than thigh usually. The bone to meat ratio is a little bit more in favor of the bone than a thigh. So I get that maybe, but like, I don't know, when I was a kid, everybody fought over the freaking drumstick. Like I saw cousins get stabbed in the hand by another cousin over who got the drumsticks, right? Like everybody wanted, nobody wants them now. Like I think I got a case of those one time, and we did use them for dog food from Costco Business Center for like 67 cents a pound. It's almost free at that point. Like it's more, it would cost more to have somebody go get it and bring it to your house than the box of the meat costs. I don't even know how they sell it that cheap, except that all you uppies paid for the breasts and that paid for me to get the legs cheap, I guess. But I got a technique for you with chicken legs, and I'm probably going to do a video on this because it would be a little bit better with a visual, but you just take your chicken leg, leave the skin on, rotate it on your cutting board into like the thinnest part of the meat, the place where the meat is closest to the bone is looking up at you. Take like a fillet knife or a fine pointed sharp knife and act like you're going to debone it. Go down both sides of the bone from both sides and peel it like you're going to debone it and like open it up like a pair of wings, like angel's wings, like a book. Okay. Leave it on the bone. Flatten it out like that. Now season it however you want and cook it, especially grilled. Okay, grilled or on a, like, if you have like a pellet smoker like I do and you run at a higher temperature where you're smoking and grilling kind of simultaneously, let me tell you what you've done. A drumstick has this truncated shape. So it's really thin on one end and thick on the other. So you're kind of cooking a little longer than you want to on the thin end to make sure the thick end is not raw. Because raw chicken, rare beef, yum. Rare chicken, hospital trip, right? We don't want that. So we even out, just like pounding a cutlet, right? We even it out. But what we created, we've made the surface area where the skin is uniform and flat so we can crisp the skin, okay? And what we want to do is we'll season it, but then we come up with a really good base to finish with. So we season it, and we start it flesh side down. We get that nice and grilled and looking good. We flip it over, and as the skin is starting to crisp and we've cooked it through and it's almost done, we take our baste and now we have this nice little bowl that we created with all that chunky Chex texture, right? That's why that'll get so nice and charred for you, because it won't be smooth. It'll be kind of, you know, textured. And so now when we baste it, there's all these little places for it to grab onto. And then before we take it off, we'll flip it over and just give a little bit more char to that baste, because that baste should have a little bit of sugar in it to caramelize. And some of those little tips will turn a little black. And it's like the best freaking chicken wing you ever eat. You want to make it super crispy? Use a little bit of baking powder in your rub, and a little bit of baking powder when it soaks into chicken skin, it makes a much crispier skin. So there's your chicken legs, like you're one of the most least sought after pieces of chicken that there is. Like people go for everything before the leg today. Again, breast is kind of the premium thing, then wings, then thigh, and then the drumstick. man. I think you're all nuts. Eat some drumsticks. I also wanted to talk to you about making soup today, but I don't want to give you a soup, right? I want to give you the soup technique. When you have the soup technique, you can always make good soup out of anything, including leftovers. And it basically is learn to make good bases, and learn to make good stocks, and then follow your instincts. So here's an example of, like, if I have I have a leftover chicken carcass, right? Maybe two. There's enough meat on it to make a good chicken soup out of it from both of them combined. So what I'm going to do then, I'm going to take and I'm going to pull all that meat and chop it up, okay? And I'm going to set that aside. It's already been cooked. I don't want to overcook it. Now that I've exposed all the bones, and like there might be still some meat, but I'm going to take the big pieces, anything I can pull easily, I'm going to pull and set that aside because there's probably going to be a bunch of stuff left on the breast because that's the least good part, but it's really good in chicken soup, and I don't want to overcook it and dry it out even more than it already is. I'm going to take those carcasses, and I'm going to throw them in the oven for 20 minutes. I'm going to brown them. I'm layering flavor, right? While they're browning, I'm going to get my pot that I'm going to make my soup in, and I'm going to give you a basic base here, a mirepoix base, but you could do a sofrito, you could do a Holy Trinity. What do you want to create out of it? But that's equal parts of celery, carrot, and onion, right? I'm going to put them in the pan with a good quality fat. Like if I'm going to go plant-based at all, it's going to be like avocado oil or coconut oil or maybe olive oil. I'm probably going to use for this chicken smalts. Because I have lots of it because I don't throw things away like that. So I'm going to, and it goes with the dish, right? So I'm going to cook those down until the carrots and celery are soft until the onions start to caramelize and brown. Okay. I'm then going to deglaze the pan. If I have stock, I'm going to use stock, right? If I don't have stock, I'll just use water. I'm going to take the chicken carcasses out of the oven and put them in the pot. I'm going to set that to a simmer. I'm going to let that run about an hour. You can do a quick soup too. I'm giving you kind of a more grandma's chicken soup type chicken soup, right? When that's done, I'm going to fish those carcasses out. I'm going to pull any remaining meat and throw it right back in there. I'm going to take my diced chicken. I'm going to put it back in there, and I'm going to add whatever vegetables I want to. Let's say celery, fine chopped celery, but you know, you've not cooked down like you did your mirepoix and some carrot. And I'm going to throw those in there. If you want to do noodles, rice, whatever, go ahead and do that. I like to do zucchini noodles because I grow Trombuccino zucchinis. I make great zucchini noodles out of them. But what I'll do with that, because they cook so fast, I'll put the zucchini noodles in the bowl and ladle the soup on top of it. But that basic process, and it might be adapted depending on what you have. You can make soups out of anything. You want to make a stew, right? Use bigger pieces of meat. Use bigger pieces of vegetables. Do all the same things. And toward the end of it, mix up a roux and thicken your stew. That's it. That's all you got to do. I'm not going to go into how to make a roux today or anything like that. That damn dog, I knew that was going to happen. We'll see if I can ignore or I'll probably have to get up and go do it. I'm also going to give you a very simple, delicious meal that you can make. This one will not be low carb, but it's really simple. And you can do it kind of... You know, maybe you go serving this with maybe a little bit of sauerkraut and some seedy homemade mustard or something if you were using something like a German bratwurst. You could take this a different direction and go more Italian with it, which is kind of the way I developed it. It's just basically sausage, potatoes, and peppers. And it's really freaking simple. You get yourself a pan, right? And you... make some cuts into your Italian sausage. Like lateral cuts are kind of the best. So you kind of crosshatch cuts, like three cuts on both sides. That will let more of the flavor render out. Brown your sausages. Pull them out of the pan. Okay? So we've browned our sausages, and we've pulled them out of the pan. We now have a nice frond. In other words, there's a brown residue in the pan. A lot of times we want to deglaze to get that frond up. But we're going to go down with... peppers. Okay. We're going to go down with some, let's say red and green sweet peppers from the garden or from the grocery store. They're immediately going to start sweating out water, and we're going to use a metal spatula, and we're going to kind of get that frond to let go so that all that flavor stays in there. And when those peppers begin to soften, we're going to take some tongs and we're going to take the peppers out. We're now going to take diced potatoes. We'll add a little bit of fat if we need to. We probably don't need to. But, you know, a tablespoon of lard in there or schmaltz or whatever would be good. And we're going to brown the potatoes in the delicious fat left over from the sausages, the Italian sausages. Now we're going to take the Italian sausages and cut them into bite-sized pieces. And once the potatoes are browned and soft enough to eat, we're going to put everything back in and mix it all together. If you want to add some sort of a tomato sauce or spaghetti sauce, that a light coating of that is delicious on there, but you don't have to. You just made a restaurant quality meal from three to four ingredients, depending on how you did it. It takes less than 30 minutes to do. It's almost easier to do than it was for me to explain it to you. And it's cheap. And that would feed a family with, you know, about the packages of Italian sausage, usually just over a pound. So 1 pound of sausage could feed a family. If it's my family, it's probably 2 packs of sausages. But the potatoes stretch it and the peppers add a sweetness. And, you know, sausage and peppers is pretty classic. All we've done is, if you notice what we did there, we replaced a pasta with a potato as a different starch. That's all that we did there. And we were able then, instead of boiling a pasta and then kind of sucking up what's left in the pan, we were able to literally cook the potato in the sausage grease, which has all the flavoring and reinforces the sausage flavor. But again, you could take that in the direction of like a German thing if you wanted to as well. It's up to you. It's just the technique. And then one of the things to really think about, you know, I mentioned doing this with chicken already, but low cost roasts makes beef roast makes some of the best lunch meat you'll ever have. And this is really simple. Come up with a good rub that you like. I like kind of going an Italian way. So we got, you know, salt and pepper. Everything gets salt and pepper. Rosemary, thyme, oregano, basil. Mixed together in a rub. And what you want to do with that is you're going to use, let's say, 2 parts salt to 1 part pepper to 1/2 part every other one of those things I gave you, the rosemary, the thyme, the oregano, and yeah, fennel's good in that too. So maybe you do those herbs and then crust it in that. Get your oven up to a very high temperature, like 400, 450 degrees. Pop a thermometer in it, and you pull it at the temperature that you want to pull it. And what I actually like to do is I'll have that oven at 400 degrees. If I want to finish that thing at like 130, when that thermometer hits 100 degrees, I'm sorry, when that thermometer hits about 110 degrees, I will kill the oven and leave the door shut, and I ain't opening it if it catches on fire. I will leave it sit there for about an hour, hour and a half. You can leave it there for half a day. It doesn't matter. It ain't going to go bad. It'll be fine. You're not going to die. Trust me. And it will have a gorgeous, beautiful bark on it from that high heat. And it will be, you know, very pink in the center if you do it what I just said. If you want it taken a little further, that's fine. You figure out what your lag time is through trial and error until you dial it in exactly the way that you want it. And when that thing comes out, you do the same thing with it that I said to do with the chicken. Put it in a vacuum seal bag and vacuum seal it. Throw it in the refrigerator a day at least. You can leave it in there for up to 3 or 4 days. It will be fine. Then take it out nice and cold. And if you don't have a meat slicer, it doesn't matter. Just slice thin with a sharp knife. If there's more than you can use in a reasonable amount of my time to store it in the refrigerator, break it into packages, vacuum seal it, throw it in the freezer. And my God, like, not only is it good for, like, everybody buys lunch meats for sandwiches and all, but charcuterie boards are huge. When you take a piece, like a top round or something, it doesn't make a really great steak, and you slice that up and you've cooked it that way, and you put that on a charcuterie board, it will be the first thing to disappear. But the same person would tell you that top round is the worst cut of meat there is. Eye round works for that too. Or another way to do it is to actually cut it into very thick steaks and grill it like steak, okay? But keep it really rare. Like, the one thing about these lean cuts, if you go to a well done with them, they will bind up that protein to where it will be tough, even sliced thin, and it will taste dry. So it has to stay, I'm sorry, those of you that have a mental defect, at least pink. Like, just give me light pink, but it has to have some pink in it or you've destroyed it. The thing about it, when you cook it like a steak and do the same thing with it, now you're cutting like long, like almost like London broil strips, but real thin to use for the same thing. It has more of that char. And you just use the same kind of a rub. Just cook it like you're making a good ribeye, and then don't treat it like a ribeye after the fact, is what I'm saying. So those are something I wanted to also give you, like, just a trip down old man Jack memory lane with some things my grandma used to make today that I think you guys might enjoy hearing about. And I'm not going to go into how to make. I'm just going to talk about them real quick, each one, so this doesn't get too long. But, I mean, we're Ukrainian, and we lived in an area that was, like, Ukrainian, Georgian, Lithuanian, Polish, Hungarian. Like, we had all these Slovakian groups and then Irish. You know, so when you add Irish to that, all you get is more potatoes. So potato, potato, potato. And just the way that immigrants of that generation fed families, potatoes always came into it. Probably the two biggest things that because potato was potato and it was in everything. Like, there was always fried potatoes with meals. And again, I'm going back to this is 1970s. People are eating the shit out of potatoes and homemade bread and not sourdough bread, though I think that is the better option. And nobody's fat. Not the way they are today. So just keep that in mind here as I go through this. But pierogies. And pierogies are, you know, everybody claims to have the best pierogi. And you can say, you can't even say nice things about the other old lady's pierogies or the first old lady is offended. Like, you just don't talk about anybody's pierogies but hers when you're eating her pierogies. Like, as my grandmother, if I said my Chuchi Bureski's pierogies were good, then my grandma would look at me, well, what about mine? Like, well, yours are better. They were. Like, yours are better. Oh, but you can still tell, like you shouldn't even mention that's how these women held onto their version of a pierogi. A pierogi is basically like a pasta pocket. So she would make her own dough, and she had a cutter. They cut an exact size, and then there's a little dollop of potato and cheese. Now, there's other things that can go in pierogies. I wasn't allowed to talk about that with my grandmother made potato and cheese. So if you talked about the fact that your Chuchi is kind of like an adopted aunt in a Ukrainian family, like they're not really your aunt, but you treat them like an aunt, like you call like your dad's best friend, Uncle Bill, right? Chuchi Bureski is like Aunt Bureski. So, you know, she did them with like a pork and sauerkraut inside them. And I learned really quick as a young, don't tell grandma that because she doesn't do that. And it means that hers aren't good. But pierogies, she would make tons of these, potato, cheese, and dough. That's it. And I mean, when I say tons, she would make a few hundred, and she did that like twice a year. And then she would freeze them, and that way you could just take them out and cook them. And there was two ways we cooked them. One was boiled in water, so they're kind of poached. And then you fry up some butter, but you do clarify. Basically, she's making ghee. She didn't know that's what it was, but you pour the butter off the solids, and then back into the pan it goes after you get rid of the solids. And then into that pan goes a handful of finely chopped onion. You cook the onion down to the translucent. You take that pierogi and you set that a couple of those on a plate and you spoon that butter and onions over. And we weren't fat, right? Explain it to me. Because you eat the commercial ones they make today, you're going to be fatter than three pigs at once, right? And that was like one of the potato things. The other one was called bellinis. And bellinis are like a potato pancake. Now, my Italian grandma used to make a similar thing, which was you took leftover mashed potatoes, maybe you mixed a little bit of cheese and onion into them, you formed them into patties cold, and then you fried them like a pancake. A bellini, though, is they take this thing to grate the potato like a cheese grater, but it's not like a cheese grater. It's like a mesh woven like metal cloth thing. It looks almost like more like a trivet than it does a grater, but a potato just it grates the potato a little bit differently than a cheese grater would. I'm sure you could do it with a cheese grater. And then she mixed in a little bit of flour and onion. And basically they were like a hash brown almost, but God, they were good. And it was really popular among some of the other ethnicities to put sour cream on that. That was not something that we did. Usually we would do like chopped green onion from the garden and a little bit of butter on top of that. And I don't know why we didn't do the sour cream, because my grandmother used sour cream and plenty of other things, just not with the bellinis. Then stuffed peppers and stuffed cabbage. So the stuffed cabbage is the traditional thing that comes out of the whole Slovakian thing. It's basically rice and ground beef stuffed inside a cabbage leaf that's rolled up. She would steam those first and then roll them up, and they would be cooked in a tomato sauce. And she would do those and stuffed peppers at the same time. Stuffed peppers and stuffed cabbage had the same stuff in them. And that was, you know, at least once every couple of weeks, that's what we were eating. Pork and sauerkraut. Yeah, it's more German, I guess, than Ukrainian, but good God, that was a, it, you know, at least once a month, it would just be a big hunk of pork shoulder that she would slow cook, and fermented sauerkraut that was warmed because she didn't want to break it. That's how she called it. I think there was a little bit of broken English there, but I don't want to break it. It means she didn't want to kill all the beneficial bacteria in it. She knew that if you cooked sauerkraut too long, so what they would do is they would take some of the sauerkraut and cook the pork in it like in a crock pot. And then that would, you know, those, that interaction of that acid and that tartness with the pork would be wonderful. And then they would add fresh sauerkraut from the crock that had never been warmed up, and they would just warm it through so it wasn't cold, usually with caraway seeds, and then the tender pork on top of that. Oh my God. And you'd eat that until you couldn't move, and then you weren't fat. Funny, huh? She was also big on fish cakes. So she made a lot of crab cakes during Lent, and pretty much every Friday. She was very, very Catholic. And we fasted every Friday by not eating meat. And apparently crab meat, lobster, et cetera, when we could afford it, was fine to fast on because it wasn't meat because the Pope said so. But whatever. But we didn't always have money for crab. Crab's expensive even today. So she would make fish cakes. And sometimes that would mean canned fish from the store. But a lot of times it would be things like, she'd say, well, are you catching any fish when you're fishing? I'd be like, yeah, but just sunnies, which are bluegill, brim, perch, whatever you want to call them, you know, these little fish. And she'd say, well, bring some home. And I'd be like, they're kind of a pain in the ass to clean, Grandma. She goes, as long as you scale them and gut them, I'll take care of it. All right. And she would basically steam them till the meat came off and then mix them in with, you know, breadcrumbs and all, just like a crab cake, and make fish cakes out of them. And they were one of the best things I ever ate. They're really, really delicious. And everything was used to make stock. There was nothing like, I don't even know what we really made compost out of when I think about it now, other than like leaves and horse manure from the neighbor. Like we there was no food waste. Like the bottom of the celery, that goes in the stock, you know. I mean, bones, by the time my grandma was done with a bone, it was a freaking dog biscuit. Like it was so soft and so safe. Even if it was a chicken bone, you could hand it to a dog and they could eat it without worrying about them choking on it. Like everything was turned into stock. Stock. Jars of canned stock. Like she would pressure can any excess chicken stock and things like that. We also had a deep freezer, so she would freeze portions of it as well if she didn't feel like canning that day or didn't have enough to make it worth doing. But everything got made into stock. And then pork stock was a necessary ingredient of one of her most famous things she made, which was bean soup. And this was like, you know, I'm telling you right now, she used the same thing I'd use today if I was making bean soup. You can buy those bags of dried beans. It's like 15 varieties of beans. She'd use like two-pound bags of that. And that got made whenever there was a piece of leftover ham. But there was also pork stock from pork bones that went into it and a little bit of bacon. And if that wasn't good enough, like then that ham bone probably got reused again and added with other bits of ham and other bits of pork to make a split pea ham and bacon soup, which was also like in wintertime, glorious to eat stuff like that. And again, all these carbs and nobody was fat. I'm just saying, right? There's some. She also used to make potato soup. This was one of my least favorite things, but it's because I love meat so much. So potato soup was a Depression era soup, and it was made with a little bit of beef bouillon for flavor. But when you were doing the beef bouillon, you were actually mixing it in as you were making a roux. So you're making kind of a thin gravy here, and then onions and potatoes. So it was pretty and milk, right? And stock is what made this. And it basically ate like was potatoes with beef gravy. It's just you had a lot more potatoes than you had gravy, like because the potatoes were like when this was served, there was no meat coming. That's why I didn't love it. And I remember I used to tell my grandma, like, you know what would make this excellent? Some cubed up beef in it. And she's like, we didn't have beef in the Depression. I'm like, Grandma, it's 1985. I will go buy you a cut of beef that we can put in there. And she would never do it. And I look back at now and I realize the arrogance of being a teenager, and she was trying to teach me something. And it was very good for what it was. It's still better with beef in it because I've made it with beef in it, and it's still better with beef in it. And then how about this? Potato skin chips. So when you cook potatoes, you can definitely cook them with the skin on, and there's a lot of times that you do, but there's certain things that you do with potatoes that you peel them. Like you don't put peel on potatoes in potato soup. The way it cooks, the skins will slough off and they're not very good. That's one example. Mashed potatoes, I like mashed potatoes with the skin on. Most people don't, so my grandma, things like that, would peel potatoes. When she would peel potatoes for chicken pot pie. Oh, I got to give you that one too. It's not on my list, but that's how my grandmother made chicken pot pie. It was a giant pie, top and bottom crust, really delicious. And it was, you know, chicken, peas, carrots, all the stuff you expect in chicken pot pie, no gravy. This is one of her genius hacks. She would bake that pie, and then you bring it out, and you let it cool the F down before you cut into it. It's still warm. It's still serving temperature. It's just not blazing hot. She would make the chicken gravy in a separate pot. When you cut the slice of the chicken pot pie, you could stick the little triangle spatula in there and lift it out in one piece onto a plate instead of it all falling apart into a mess. And then you ladled the hot gravy on top of it, and it that way the gravy was soaked into the crust, but it didn't like completely turn the bottom crust into mush. It was so damn good. That woman was a genius. That's a, yeah, like I said, she would destroy a steak, but on something she was a freaking genius, right? But when she would peel potatoes, if there was enough to do it, she would do it right away. If like it wasn't really enough, you're going to do it at the end of the week, she would take those potato peelings and freeze them and then take them out later in the week, and then we would deep fry the potato peelings. And then you take those and just as soon as they come out of the fryer, hit them with salt. And so when I would be asked to peel the potatoes, which was pretty common, once I knew that was a thing, I would dig just a little deeper with that potato peeler so there's a little bit more potato on that skin. You know, there's a reason potato skins are on the appetizer menu of every freaking restaurant. Now take that to the limit and make it actually crunch with salt. And again, we weren't fat. Of course, what you fry them in? Freaking lard. I'm just saying. And then for dessert, her two big things were using leftovers to make something amazing. And sometimes the leftovers were planned. So this was either rice pudding or bread pudding. And I won't get into how to make those, but both of them were exceptional. And she always put raisins in the rice pudding, which many in my family did not care for. I thought, I don't really care for eating raisins, but when they plump up like that and they're sweet and they're mixed in with the rice and the cream and all, great. And then bread pudding was just, you know, leftover homemade bread would get cubed up and you make a custard and you make a bread pudding. It was a very, very, very common thing up there. Now, here's the thing. I said I wasn't going to be bound by low carb today, but I want to acknowledge that, like, my results prove that going low carb works. And I think what it, the part of why it works is, one, you're bringing your hormones into balance. The human body is optimized to live on protein and fat. We have no required amount of carbohydrate. There is no such thing as an essential carbohydrate to humans. If you take a human being and you feed them a diet of, let's say, 70% protein and 30% fat and nothing else, they will live a long, healthy life. I'm not saying you can't add carbohydrates to that and not have them still live a long, healthy life. I'm saying they will. If you take all the fat away in a relatively, against a human lifetime period, the person will die. If you take all the protein away, the person will die. We have essential fats and we have essential proteins. We do not have essential carbohydrates. That doesn't mean that carbohydrates are in of themselves as a thing bad. So here's my suggestions to stay healthy if you want to make carbs part of your life. Number one, make your own bread or buy from someone who does or buy from an artisanal bakery that uses real ingredients that you can pronounce, and there's no reason for there to be, you know, more about three ingredients in bread. Maybe certain breads, four. But if there's a multisyllabic word on the ingredients list for your bread, you are not eating human food. You are not eating human food, and I will not apologize. It is not human food. We just started to become friends with a couple that lives only about three quarters of a mile from us, and the wife and the couple make sourdough. We'll buy stuff from her. I'd rather do that than drive down to the artisanal bakery down in Arlington to do it. So if that wasn't the case, I was actually about to start making it myself. Just I'm going to eat, you know, maybe one loaf or two loaves a month. So I don't need to be going through all the crap to do that for myself. Find somebody else if you're not going to do it. That would be number one. It is the number one thing that people do not want to give up that can be better just by making it yourself. And I would say sourdough is the best practice, but you could go a long way even using like a baker's yeast if you will use the right grains and the right other ingredients. You'll still be ahead. And there's a book on my website about making bread. I'll link to it from today's show notes that uses a pseudo sourdough like method using regular yeast where you just keep the dough in the refrigerator. You can make a loaf a day and you only actually produce the dough on Sundays. It's kind of cool. I just can't remember the name of the book right now. But use also only whole real ingredients. You know, eat whatever you want in the end, like is what I've always said, but really, if you want to stay healthy, like if it comes in a bag or a box, you probably shouldn't be eating it. And here's what I found that's funny. Every once in a while, I'll remember like a comfort food I really loved. Like Xanarin's makes this red beans and rice, and I had some really great smoked sausage. And I was at the store, and I'm like, what would it hurt? It'll just be one day. I ended up throwing it away. I ate one bowl of it, and I felt so physically miserable from it. And I'm like, how did I ever eat this shit before? And then I was like, well, was I just miserable that day or so? So then I tried like a little bit more. Like, oh, that's it. And it tasted great. But it made me physically sick because my body's not used to it anymore. I'm no longer adapted to the toxicity in this shit. So cook from scratch with real ingredients. No seed oils. None. Olive oil is not a seed oil. But what about olives, Jack? It doesn't come from the pit. It comes from the fruit. Avocado does not come from the pit. It comes from the fruit. Those are fruit oils. They're also not the best, but they're okay. Seed oils are canola, soy, corn. No, don't eat that shit. And the thing is, when you look at the amount of oil in a soybean, the amount of soybeans you would have to eat to get the amount of fat when somebody cooks something with soy oil, is you would never eat it. It exceeds what's acceptable for a human to take in from a volume standpoint. I don't care if we are meant to eat a soybean or not. We are not meant to eat the extracted oil of a soybean. We are not meant to eat canola at all, but we're definitely not meant to eat the extracted oil of a canola seed, a rapeseed. That's not, our bodies are not physically designed to do that. If you're going to use flours, grains, or rice, and anything like that, pay for organic. It's so inexpensive anyway that the premium for organic is totally worth it. And it's not just about, you know, it's supposedly better quality or whatever. What it really is about is it has a hell of a lot less toxins in it. It's the only way to know that you're not eating something that was sprayed with an herbicide, like wheat they spray with herbicide, glyphosate, to kill it and dry it out to make harvesting easier. The stuff, you know, when you're looking at soy, unless you're buying organic, then you're looking at soy that was absolutely sprayed with glyphosate because it's Roundup Ready soy. It's designed to be sprayed with it. Why would you pay the money for a patented seed that allows you to spray glyphosate to not spray glyphosate? So just to protect yourself from toxins, especially in things like this, you really need to stay away from non-organic options, right? Even if you're not low carb, try to keep it under 100 carbs a day. And that's total carbs, not the net carb thing. 100 carbs a day total. You can eat a lot of things at 100 carbs a day. Most people that I've worked with on this, when they've, like, I've had people email me, I want to do the dietary thing, whatever. And my first thing is, I want you to get this app, keto.app. And if you're not doing keto, I don't care. I just want you to use it, and I want you to enter everything you eat for a week, and I want you to come back to me and tell me how many carbs you're consuming in a week. Because I'll say, how many do you think you're consuming? Like 100, 150. The average person will come back somewhere between 300 and 600 grams of carbs per day. They're just not paying attention, and we're going to get to why that's the case here in just a second. And so usually at that point, they're more than willing to do it because they had no idea what they were doing. And carbohydrates are sugars. And that, again, not by itself alone does not make them bad per se, but that's a lot of sugar. And it is the same as eating sugar because your body is going to transform the starch into simple sugar so it can use it. It's going to spike your blood sugar. If I take 10 pounds of sugar or 10 pounds of white bread and 10 pounds of potato, all three, I put all three separately into fermentation buckets. I add yeast and water and I ferment them and I put them through a still. I will get the exact same amount of ethyl alcohol from all three. Okay. There's only one thing that can make ethyl alcohol that I know of anyway, and that's a yeast consuming sugar. It consumes the sugar and it poops out CO2 and it poops out ethanol. That's how. So when you can put 10 pounds of white cane sugar or 10 pounds of bread into two different buckets and get the same amount of alcohol, that tells you that you're dealing with the same amount of sugar because that's what it is. And it might be a milliliter or two one way or the other, but in general, you're going to get the same amount. So keep those carbs in check under 100, kind of put setting a ceiling at 75 is better. And I say that because a lot of the meals are 105, right? But you're already really pushing it. So like your budget, right? Like set your budget a little lower because that way when you go a little over, you're still really within it. So 75 is a good number. Three meals a day, that's 25 carbs a meal. If you have one meal without carbs, you might need to be under that because, you know, you really don't want like 50 carbs in one meal. 25 carbs in a meal is a pretty decent amount of carbohydrate. You know, maybe you can go as high as 35 for dinner, maybe have none at lunch, or maybe skip breakfast altogether and just do two meals a day. If you eat the way we're talking about today, that's going to be very doable. And I want to talk about why is everybody fat, though? We started out with that, right? Like, if you get video of people on the beach in 1977, like, I'm not going to say everybody's skinny, but nobody's obese. Or there's like one, and if there is, you're like, it sticks out like a sore thumb. Like, look at the fat guy, right? Like when I was in school in the 80s, we had a fat kid. We didn't have fat kids. We had the fat kid. His name was Jason. He was in a couple classes with me. We were friends with him. Like he was part of my group of friends. But sorry, Jason, you were fat, right? Like there was like one fat girl and one fat guy in a high school with like, I think we had like right at 800 people. About 200 per class. And then the last year I was in school, they merged another school with us and we had like 1200. And out of 1200 kids, we had two fat ones across four grades. And today, just like everybody's fat. Everybody's fat. Every other person anyway is fat. Well, here's the six big changes. And I don't think this will surprise most of you guys, but I think sometimes seeing them all together in one place and then having the context of like people ate this food all the time and nobody was fat. What's going on? Right. Number one is high fructose corn syrup. High fructose corn syrup is probably the worst thing that we did to the food supply. And when people, it's sugar, it's sugar. No, it's not. No, it's not. Chemically, high fructose corn sugar is not the same as cane or beet sugar, white sugar that you would think of. It just isn't. And it is so freaking cheap, and the price is driven down by corn subsidies. We grow more corn than we need, and that leads to a host of other – so all these environmental people that think we would all be better off if everybody was vegetarian, if we would cut the corn production alone, the amount of runoff that would stop going into the rivers and streams and oceans would be worth it. And we grow corn to make gas that is a net loss – when we make gas out of it, it's cheaper to make it out of oil. So we actually lose money turning it into ethanol for gas. We make corn into oil that we have no need of and is not healthy for us. And we make corn into high fructose corn syrup, which is basically a toxin. Okay. I'm not saying if you ate it once or twice in your life, it would have any effect on you at all, but eating it consistently over time, it is a toxin. It's also now loaded up with herbicides. Like they don't use glyphosate on corn because it's a grass, but they use an herbicide called atrazine. So the corn that they grow to make in the corn syrup is just not, they're not concerned with what they spray on it at all. Cause it's going to be processed anyway. It'll all be fine. So it's loaded with atrazine in addition to the fact that it is a liver toxin. right? And I would say it is a liver toxin equal to the toxicity of alcohol without the intoxicating effects, so you'll eat more of it. Yeah. Next is the low-fat and seed oil craze at the same time. So we went crazy with this war against fat. I can't think of the doctor's name now, but it was a doctor that was very well known. He was actually a personal doctor to President Eisenhower, and he went on this war against fat, and fat was the evil. Fat caused heart attacks. And by the 70s, people had really started to take this in and accept it. And then by the 80s, the food companies went nuts with low fat, no fat, less fat, negative fat, like boxes fat free, like everywhere. No fat. No. Look how much better. We have no fat. Okay. Human beings are going to eat a certain amount of calories every day to maintain stasis, to just have enough caloric input to manage their energetic needs of their output, right? We're going to balance that. We're going to eat more calories. And that means that when we eat a portion of food, we want a certain amount of calories out of that portion. And manufacturers, by and large, despite shrinkflation, kind of build the portions to that caloric demand. So if we take the fat out, there's only a couple things we can do to balance this out. We can, A, increase the carbohydrates, which is cheap and adds a lot of profit margin to it. So guess which one they tend to do. Or we can add more protein, which is expensive and reduces the profit margin and increases the final retail sales price. It means you sell less. So which one of those two do you think they do? A, you're correct. They add more cheap carbohydrates. And this leads to another problem later on. The other thing you can do is replace the good fat with a shitty fat. So if corn oil is part of the farm subsidy world, if soy oil and canola oil are all part of the farm subsidies that are supposedly there to make sure that people have the basic things they need to eat in an affordable price, because what this all used to be was like meat, dairy, and eggs. These were the primary subsidies if you go back before this modern era of bullshit. Right. But now we're subsidizing this stuff that's not even food. Why are we subsidizing canola? Why in the hell would we ever need to do that? Who eats it other than in oil form? So now you have the super cheap fat full of toxins, but it's considered food. And you're a manufacturer. And if you take all the fat out of this thing, it's not going to work. So you put the cheap fat in, you take away the beef fat, the tallow, or you take away the pork fat, the lard. Or the chicken fat, the schmaltz. And you market it as being healthy because your government said it was. That is a huge part of our problem. The low-fat craze combined with seed oil replacement philosophy. Next up on that is food companies fully dialing in the bliss point. The bliss point is where you have the right amount of kind of that umami flavor, okay? And that comes from MSG, more on that in a bit, because MSG itself is not bad. But that umami flavor, fat, sugar, salt. And if you can add a spice to it, a little bit of heat, it's even better. When you get that perfect, you create that perfect bite in the mind, even if it really isn't. And so the whole thing with Lay's, you can't just eat one. Well, when they started that saying, it was an advertisement. Okay? Because Lay's at the time were made from friggin', it was basically chips, thin sliced potatoes, fried in lard with salt. That was it. That was it. That was the whole thing. That's all it was. But what is it now? What is it now? It's all kinds of other shit. A little bit of sugar. They put a flavor. It's got to have a barbecue or, you know, some weird ass flavor, you know, tempting taco or whatever the hell they come up with, right? And it also has some just some MSG, monosodium glutamate added to it. And so those things together with the crunch and the even though it's a garbage fat, it's still a fat and a sugar and a little bit of a spice. Now you can't eat just one is a freaking brag. It's a brag. It's a statement of fact. It's impossible. You eat that one and your brain goes, whoa, you need to eat another one of those. And this is part of a deep-seated biological evolutionary component to human beings. In nature, it is very rare that you find fat and carbohydrate together at the same time. Very, very rare. Just think about foraging. You kill the deer in the fall, there's not that much fruit around. Maybe a little bit of overlap, like apples and venison or something. In the spring, you know, that's traditionally, even with indigenous societies, a lot less hunting is done because they knew it was important for the females to reproduce. And so then you're living more off like the earth itself. And so even if you're gathering up, like what is most plentiful is never the two things together. So the times it does happen is spring, early spring, when we're coming out of our winter and we need to put weight back on, and early fall before we head into winter, when we need to put weight on to make it through winter if we don't live in a place with supermarkets. And that's when you get that magic moment when like the salmon are running and the berries are there. And so we were biologically hardwired that when those two things come together, eat as much as you can. Then you add chemistry to it and the psychology of this bliss point, and people eat more than they ever have. They don't stop eating. The food is low in nutrients, so it's not satiating. It's made with a garbage fat, so it's not satiating. It's high in sugar, so it's addictive. And this bliss point thing is not some shit YouTubers like me made up. This is industry science. This is in industry literature. They are the ones that named it what it was. And when they put food chemistry along with culinary input from like cooks, they were able to develop this thing that makes you eat more. Now, I said MSG isn't bad. I know some of you are like, MSG is terrible. I can't even eat MSG. Do you eat tomatoes? Yeah, then you eat MSG. Do you eat mushrooms? Yeah, you eat MSG. Do you eat onions? Yeah, you eat MSG. It's natural MSG. It's the same molecule. It's the exact same molecule. People tell me, I can't eat Chinese food, man. The MSG, man, it gives me hives. While they're shoving freaking Fritos or freaking, you know, freaking elephant-flavored Pringles in their mouth or something, right? Like, shut up. Just shut up. Almost all the packaged food on the planet has MSG in it. That's also part of why people think it's a bad thing, because it's one of the processed ingredients. It's just monosodium glutamate, right? It is in dozens and dozens of foods you eat all the time. I actually have a jar, a little bit of it left anyway, of MSG Jake Robinson made for me. Based on a video that Google Foods did where he took all the natural forms of MSG. It was like tomatoes, it was onion peel, mushroom, bunch of different things that were then freeze-dried, made into a powder, and then mixed back together. And so it's all natural MSG. You know what? It makes food taste exactly like crystallized MSG. MSG is not the problem itself. However, when we add it to processed food to increase the bliss point, it becomes a triggering mechanism. So there's nothing wrong with when you make one of those rubs for your roast or your chicken or whatever, throwing some MSG in it. There's nothing wrong with that. It won't hurt anything. And you're going to like make the food taste better. When you're putting it on processed food and it increases consumption, that's when it's a problem. Doubt me if you will, but do the research for yourself and you'll find out that what I told you is true. Onions, MSG. Mushrooms, MSG. Tomatoes, MSG. Almost anything with that funky umami taste has MSG in it. That's where that funky umami taste comes from. Then the other thing is GMOs increase the herbicide levels in our food. And I do not believe the human endocrine system can work properly when it is being attacked by an endocrine disruptor, which is what glyphosate is. It's a plant endocrine disruptor. And you and plants are not as different as you think you are when it comes to things like that. So you have a much higher use of herbicide today on our food than we have ever had in human history. Because in the past, if you put herbicide on your food, you killed your food before you could eat it. So these GMOs have allowed us to spray herbicides on the food that we're going to eat before we eat it. And it's freaking suicidal as a civilization. Then portion sizes of cheap carbs exploded, especially in restaurants. So it used to be if you went to like even a McDonald's, right, you got your quarter pounder with cheese and it was actually a quarter pound burger. And it was made with like a good bun. It wasn't sourdough or anything. It was a good quality bun. It wasn't complete junk. And it had some decent vegetables on it, maybe some okay cheese. And then there was this little hand-sized fries. In fact, I can remember when there were no sizes for the fries. When I was a little kid and we occasionally got to go to McDonald's, you got a burger and fries. There was no medium, large, super size, none of that. It was a little package of fries. That's all you got. So what ended up happening was the supersize concept. But now go to any kind of bar, pub, restaurant type that serves like American classic, like when you get a burger and fries or something. What does everybody do? Even like a mid-tier steakhouse, like a Texas Roadhouse or a Logan's Roadhouse or something like that. You order your steak and they send you a little 10-ounce steak. And then they say two sides. You say, I don't know, fries is one of your sides. The portion of fries is good enough for three people. Why? Because the potato costs them almost nothing. When you're buying at their level and volume, now you made the customer feel like they got, so you shrink the protein portion and you expand the carbohydrate portion and you make more money even selling it for the same price. And then when you raise the price, you really make more money. So then we have created this idea in people's mind that if I don't get my plate completely full, I'm not getting my money's worth. And then that psychology translates into not only when they eat out, but when they eat at home and what they make and how much they make of it. And the junkier, the cheaper, the lower quality the carbohydrate product is, the more of it a person will eat as a survival mechanism because their body knows they're not getting enough nutrient. So the only way to get more nutrient is to eat more of what's available. And if anybody tells you it's more complicated than this, they're wrong. I'm sorry. This is why the videos of people in 1975 were skinny and the people in 2025 are fat. Same people. No, not everybody was on a freaking jazzercise quest in the 70s. Not every kid immediately started running all day long after he got out of school. Right? We were outside playing and shit, but we didn't get enough physical activity, and certainly adults didn't, to account for this differential. And it's not like there's no blue-collar construction jobs left or anything. And there's plenty of fat guys doing physically hard labor. Maybe they would be fatter if they weren't, but they're fat. It's our diet that caused this. We're the same people. We didn't genetically change in the last 70 years. We weren't that much more active 70 years ago. You can't blame social media and screenagers for all of this. I'm sorry, you can't. And then generally recognized as safe or grass. Legislation, right? It led to unnecessary food additives in things that don't really benefit from them from a nutritional standpoint. In other words, as long as something was on the grass sheet, like like this thing is like another thing that's considered safe, you could just throw it in the food. So if your chemist decided that adding this will make people eat, you know, 1 ounce more per serving, you did it. You did it. You didn't have to get any kind of approval. It's generally recognized as safe. Like, if it was salt and you got salt from the Himalayas instead of salt from freaking Utah, I'd say they're equivalent. What they consider generally recognized as safe because something else is like it is not that. It's not that at all. So these go down to things like food dyes. Well, this dyes like that dyes. So since that dyes okay, this dyes okay. It doesn't need its own individual approval. Different preservatives, different combinations of preservatives. It's one thing to say this preservative is generally recognized as safe, and this preservative is generally recognized as safe. But have you looked at what the effects are when you put the two of them together? And how long is your research timeline? See, the things in our food supply do not kill us overnight, or they wouldn't be there. Because the food manufacturers don't want to kill their customers quickly anyway, because then there's no customers left. And when people start dying eating your potato chips, when they're like, well, what do these people all have in common? Well, they all ate brand X potato chips, and within 5 days they all died. Nobody buys that brand anymore. So that doesn't happen. But if they happen to kill you over 50 years, if they have to shorten your life by 10, if they happen to, you're going to live the same life, but your last 10 years are going to be really crappy compared to what they could have been, they don't care. They don't care. And they're not even thinking about that when it happens. All they want to know is, if I put this thing in there, does it make me more money? That's it. And that's led to an explosion of combinations of ingredients and harmful additives that each one of them alone may be a problem. But when you stack them on top of each other, they become a massive problem in the health of average person. That's why we're fat today. So here's my question for you here at the end. And I'm going to take y'all's questions. And I got like five here, and I will scroll through a little bit to see if there's any more I missed. I got up to the first one that starred without seeing any. So I'm going to flash these questions while I'm talking. If you don't see your question and you're still here or your comment, re-ask it, because if it's not one of these five, then I don't have it for, and I won't be able to answer it for you. So this is kind of last call for questions here. So those are the ones that we're going to handle. And my question for you, though, is this. What are your favorite cheap eats? What are your favorite childhood memories of food? Don't even worry about whether it's healthy or not, especially if you, when your child, you're talking about your childhood being in the 70s and back, it's probably healthier than most things today anyway. I would love to get a ton of you guys to email me and tell me your favorite cheap eats, foods that your maybe depression era grandparents made, things that you remember an aunt or an uncle or a great aunt or an uncle making, things that when you came home and you smelled it, you got excited. You knew what it was very well. You got excited. I'll give you one more example of that. So my grandmother was extremely Catholic. I'm talking about not just every Sunday, but every holy day of obligation. Like, and there's a lot of them in the Catholic faith. You know, she was at the church. She went to church every Sunday and every Wednesday, plus every holy day of obligation for whatever reason. So we took certain parts of the Catholic faith very seriously, including Lent. So as you head into Lent, you have kind of this last day before Lent where you have special treats. And she made homemade donuts. She made homemade donuts. And she would make the dough and cut the little hole out of the center and then roll the little holes in the little balls. And because I like them so much, I think she made extra balls. And she'd make donuts and then donut holes, just like a donut shop does. But they were fried. And then she was just a fried plain cake donut. And then just a little super light dusting of powdered sugar. When I say a light dusting, I mean like it looks like somebody had dandruff on it. Like that's kind of gross to think about, but I'm trying to give you like maybe the salt on a soft pretzel, except it's fine powder, right? Not like a rolled in thing like that. Just a little tiny bit of that extra sweetness. Oh my God, those things were good. And her house, the front door opened straight into the kitchen. So obviously you could see what she was doing. When I was in the driveway and got out of the car, and she'd be doing that in springtime, so the windows are open on the house and all because she's cooking in the kitchen, I could smell that, and I knew exactly what it was. Is there Holishki. Email it to me, guys. Email it to me, guys. Like, somebody's propping them in here right now. Like, email me this stuff. jackofthesurvivalpodcast.com, TSPC food in the subject line. And if we get enough of these, I'll do another show that I'll talk about everybody's favorite food. And you get a chance to be on the apple and cherry fritters. Oh, see, I was never big on the cherry, like pies and stuff like that. But apple, I think cherry and blueberry to me got too sweet. Like, we used to pick a lot of blueberries. And my grandmother would make blueberry pie, and it's, like, just too sweet. But she would also make, like, this, like, giant sheet cake that was basically, like, a coffee cake with blueberries in it. It was like a sheet cake blueberry muffin. Holy crap. And we weren't fat. I'm back to that again. It's funny. Like, she didn't make that from a box mix. It was all from scratch, and it was delicious. But let's go ahead now. I'm going to take some of y'all's questions and comments here and see what I can do with them. Trial Error 8728. Question, what type of zucchini did you say you grow that you make zucchini noodles out of? Now, you can make zucchini noodles out of any zucchini. But I like to grow trombocino zucchini. Trombone, there's a bunch of different zacompete, I think, is another, like the Italian word for them. They're basically like a long neck pumpkin, but when they first grow, they're light green and they taste just like zucchini. But the neck portion, there's no seeds. So when you take that neck portion, you cut it off and you peel it, and then you make zucchini noodles out of it. And I do recommend the picante or whatever, like the tromboncino, I do recommend peeling it. The peeling, even once they get pretty big, is a bit thicker than your typical normal bush zucchini. But if you have, I don't remember what it's called now. I have it on my website. If you put zoodles in, you'll find it. It looks like a pencil sharpener, right? I don't have one of the spiralizers. But you just take and it's like sharpening a pencil and just noodles come out of it. And it's a fantastic way to do things. And what I do when I make those, I sprinkle a little salt on them because it pulls the extra moisture out of them. Let them sit for a while and I towel them off with paper towel and throw that paper towel out. And then you can either throw them in a pan for just a couple seconds with like some olive oil and salt and just do a side dish. Or like I said, if you want them in a soup, what you can do is then put them in the bowl and then just put the hot soup on them. That's all they need. There's a lot of things you can do with them. You can also make really good zucchini lasagna if you want a low-carb lasagna. Those you can either Like, I'll take them and put them in the food processor and just make discs out of them and just lay the discs out per layer. Or you take a potato peeler and you make long noodles off that neck. And then you lay those down. As the reason I don't like to do that, it looks more like lasagna, but they tend to like want to pull out when you bite into it instead of, you know, cutting nice and smooth for you. So that's what I was talking about with those zucchinis. Comment from Rach, no, Bill Hudson first. Sorry. No, wait, this is jumping all over the place. Have you found, just trial and error again, have you found a good bulk source of quality seasonings to make your own sausage? I buy mostly from a company called Frontier Organics. There's also a company called Spicy World and several others that I have bulk items listed on my website. tspaz.com is where you can find all my product recommendations. More on that in a bit. But Spicy World and Frontier Organics are both great sources of organic bulk spice. And that's where I get most of them. And I order them on Amazon because I don't have to go to the store and pay five times as much for a little ass bottle. Carl Hall, 3015, comment, meats will likely be going on sale soon due to Memorial Day later in the month. Should also watch for sales leading up to July 4th. Absolutely. I have seen some stupid low prices on, like, New York Strip, T-bones and things like that. Very thick ones usually when they do that. I mean, like, last year, I think it was, they did T-bones, and some of them were actually porterhouses, like a small, like the small side porterhouses, but they had a little bit of that filet on them. I think it was $4.99 a pound, and it was USDA choice at that price. And they said you can only buy, I think, two packages. Yeah, I went back three times. I see what you're doing there. I'm going to buy the two biggest packages, and then I'm going to go home to my car. This, when I say I went three times, I don't mean I came home. I went back inside and did it again, and I went back inside and did it again. And you know, meat freeze as well. I'll leave it at that. And there's a lot of other things you can do to preserve your meat. Bill says, this may be a stupid question. I hate plucking. So if I skin my chickens, is it possible to render the skins? Maybe. It sounds nasty, and I don't think you would want to. And I get it. I don't pluck freaking anything anymore when I harvest my own. I don't. We don't keep chickens anymore, but when I did, I just pop the breasts out, pop the leg quarters out, yank the carcass out of the center, throw the skin away, and you know, that's it. That's what we did. And with ducks, we pretty much do the same thing. It's too much work unless you're set up for it. If you have scalder and a plucker, sure. But I don't think that would be possible. So maybe it's worth it. You know, if you're just doing cold birds, Bill, that's why I don't have a setup. It's not worth it. If I was processing, you know, 50 birds twice a year, I would get all the proper equipment, and then it would be worth doing. And then one thing to remember when you're doing plucked birds, people get really like in a bind about like all the little, you know, tiny pin feathers and shit on the back and all. You can just forget about, don't worry about that. And as far as the wingtips, cut those things off. Rachel says, comment, when you make chicken pot pie noodles using schmaltz mixed in with the butter in the dough. Huh. I think what she's, pot pie noodles using schmaltz mixed in with the butter in the dough. I'm not sure what you're saying, Rachel. Please explain that further. Inquiring minds want to know. If you don't get that in before I finish here, email me exactly what you're saying there. Chicken schmaltz noodles and dough for chicken pot pie. I almost don't think it matters how you put those things together. I think they're going to be very good. Does it mean like there's noodles inside the dough and the dough's made with schmaltz? Or does it mean you make the dough with schmaltz, you put noodles inside the pie? That's a lot of carbs on top of carbs, but I want to know what we're talking about here. Let me know, Rachel. All right, with that, guys, I do want to wrap up. I want to tell you I do have a great item of the day for you. I mentioned T-Spaz a couple times. If you go to T-Spaz, you can help us out when you start your shopping there, no matter what you eventually buy. But everything that I've ever reviewed is at tspaz.com. And the item of the day I have for you today, as you might imagine, is a cooking item, something for your kitchen. This is a carbon steel skillet. It's made by a company called Merton and Stork. This is a German company. These are the best made carbon steel pans I have ever put my hands on that do not require me to mortgage a kidney to purchase. These are not, you know, $300 a pan pans. These sell for right at the same price as an equivalent Lodge carbon steel skillet. Okay. When I say that, I mean that, like, if the 12 inch Lodge is $48 that day, the Merton and Stork might be $50. And if the 9 inch is, you know, 42, the Merton and Stork might be 40. It could go a buck or two in either direction per size on any given day, but it's always so close it doesn't matter. The way these are built is amazing. The biggest complaint I've had about Lodges, and I agree, they tend to have a bit of a high spot in the center. These things are dead flat level. If your egg slides to one side in this pan, your stove isn't level. I mean, that's the way that I'll put it, and I'm correct when I say it. The riveting of the handle is fantastic. The length of the handle is such that unless you're really cooking the shit out of it or you put it in the oven, you can generally pick the pan up by the handle without burning yourself. Generally, you got to, you know that for yourself, what your tolerance is all. It is a milled, smooth carbon steel. It comes pre-seasoned. It's an excellent seasoning. These things just get better constantly. Nothing I cook in this sticks anymore. I've been using this one for about a year. I will never buy a Lodge again. Not because Lodge did anything wrong, because Merton and Stork just did it better and Lodge has not caught up. The Germans have their shit together when it comes to making a lot of things, especially things out of metal and especially out of cookware. These are absolutely flipping fantastic. I highly recommend you add them to your kitchen. And then when you do that, you're going to see that your results will go up. And that's the kind of pan to use to brown your ground meat instead of gray your ground meat. Remember, when we brown meat, it's supposed to get color on it. If it turns gray, we did something wrong. Let's see. Rachel says, sorry, dude, at work, PA Dutch chicken pot pie. Is noodles not crust? You smalt with the butter to make the noodles chicken flavor through the noodle. I know what you're talking about now. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. That's pretty good stuff. Yeah. It's like a casserole made like a pie, basically, but you make your own noodles. Yeah. You know what else is good to do that with is what are they called? It's like a noodle dumpling type thing, but it's made with potato. Damn it. What are they called? You roll them little. I got 1,000 different noodle names coming and it's not the right thing, but you do that with, and you use for your fat, you use chicken smalts. Those are pretty damn good too. Anyway, or spetzel, but never mind. Anyway, guys, I really appreciate everybody tuning in today. I hope it made you a little bit hungry and I hope I, you know, kind of reinforce some things to you. One, how to eat healthier, even if you don't want to follow exactly the example that I set. Two, how you can actually make your food taste better. And three, how you can save money and still eat like a king. Take care, guys. I'll catch you tomorrow. And tomorrow will not be a live stream. It will be an expert panel Q&A. And that reminds me, I need to email Chris Rossini over at the Ron Paul Liberty Report because he usually gets me their weekly segment Wednesday evening. I have to do that because my interview this week had to go out. It's Noki. Damn it. That's what it's called. Noki is what I was talking about there. Anyway, my interview had to get moved to a Thursday this week. For it to work for my guest. So with that in mind, I will have an expert panel show for you tomorrow, and then we will be back here live with a guest interview on Thursday this week, and that will round out the week. Take care, guys. I'll catch you then. They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.